Hey, indie filmmakers, I'm Griffin Hammond.
I'm Nick Bodmer, and today we find out if Griffin can pass the FAA's new drone pilot test. I guess no.
Your guess is that I could not pass it?
That's right. That's right.
Well, I'm going to spoil the surprise. I'm going to show you a document that I have here.
Can you imagine
what I'm holding up?
Was I wrong? Did you pass?
I passed. I'm holding
Congrats.
My certificate of achievement that
wow.
Griffin James Hammond has successfully completed the FAA Safety Team Aviation Learning Center online course called Part 107 Small UAS Recurrent, which is a mouthful.
I'm so proud of you. Are you going to get a frame for that and hang it in your office in a place of honor?
No, though I have learned through my training with the FAA that I do need to carry a physical version of this certificate around when I fly.
That was on the test, huh?
Yeah. They let you carry around a small version, not the big full sheet version.
All right, now let me remember. Part 107 is really just for people flying drones in some sort of commercial fashion. Is that accurate?
Right. They're in the U.S. If you're flying, I mean, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, has authority over all of the airspace, and you can fly for fun as a hobbyist without any sort of certification. But if you want to make money, and there are many other special rules you get to follow as a Part 107 pilot, that's the certification you want to get.
Got it.
And I think the FAA would be sticklers. I think they would say if you throw a drone video up on YouTube and monetize it, that's flying commercially.
Seems like it. So people should pay attention. Or like, you know, what if you're a real estate agent and you're trying to get shots of the house you're selling? That's probably commercial too, right?
Yeah, that's definitely commercial, yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's even a question on the test that I just took that was like, if a football team wants you to come film their game with a drone and they trade you with football tickets, are you operating under Part 107? Yes, you are.
Got it.
Because even
nobody has ever offered me tickets to a sporting event in return for videography services, but I would be okay with that.
Yeah.
Like a pro football team. I'm not sure
right.
I'd go see the local high school team, but.
Well, we should explain what this test even is. This is when you want to be a Part 107 certified pilot, you first have to take the initial test, which I took 2 years ago, and it costs $160. You pay an in-person testing center to take this test. You still have to do that in-person test to get started, but every 2 years, you're supposed to re-up your certification. And until this month, until April, you had to do it at an in-person facility, the recurrent test, and so you had to pay another $160. But back at the beginning of this year, the FAA said they were going to do a new online test, online training, and their own test, and it's free. And it finally came out, I think April 6th. It was delayed like a month, but it finally came out. And then today I did it.
Huzzah.
And
so you're good for what, another 2 years?
Yeah, so now I'm good for 2 years. And I needed a topic for today's episode. So to tell you how easy this training is, I decided this morning I should do it and take the test. And the training took me like 90 minutes max. And I took the test. You have 90 minutes to take the test once you get to the end. And you want to guess how fast I took it? It's only 45 questions.
How many questions? 45 questions. I'm going to guess it took you 8.5 minutes.
That's exactly right.
It's not.
I did not put that in the script, right?
No, you didn't. I just did the little math in my head. No, wait, how long did it really take you?
8 minutes, 28 seconds.
I should go buy a lottery ticket. I swear to God, not planned. That was really my guess.
Can you guess how many, what my percent correct was?
Forty-five questions. I'm going to say 100%.
I got three wrong. I got 93%.
Dang. Now, what you should have done is said, I got three wrong and see if I could do the math and get to the percentage, which I probably could not have done live.
Yeah.
So that would have been better.
But. Well, I did better than my initial test. The initial test, I think you have to get 70 to pass, I believe. And I think I got like 83 or something. So
8.5 minutes. Such a good guess. I'm so impressed with myself. It's really great.
So
you're a good test taker. We've always known that, Griffin.
Well, and I think you could answer some of these questions pretty well, too. I guess I wanted to convey to anyone who needs to re-up their certification after 2 years that this thing doesn't take all that long. It's kind of like, it's similar to like the kind of training you would take at your job for like, you know, you have to take like an ethics training annually or sexual harassment or something.
It They're feels always kind of like so that. Well-produced, those,
yeah,
those sessions.
It kind of has that same feel of like...
It's got little animated people and like... Look at this scenario.
Right, yeah.
That's and fun. Can you give me, like, do you have any of the questions in front of you? Can you ask me one to see if I know?
Let's see if you can answer any of these questions. I feel like half of them are pretty much just common sense or like, I mean,
like
a lot of
eliminate
them,
two of the answers immediately and then use common sense to figure out the other two.
It's 45 questions and each one has three possible answers. So let me give you one here. Let's see. Here's a good example one. And I feel like this is a great example because the question sounds complicated, but I think you'll have no problem zeroing in on the right answer. According to 14 CFR Part 107, who is responsible for ensuring that all control links between the ground control station and the small unmanned aircraft are working properly? A, manufacturer, B, owner or operator, C, remote pilot in command.
B?
Owner or operator?
Does that mean the person operating the controls?
Yeah, I guess maybe you do need to take the training to understand this terminology.
Oh, yeah, I don't know the term. I was like remote, like would that be somebody who's telling you what to do? But when they say remote, they mean the person at the controls, not the person who owns the device.
That's right, yeah.
Ah.
In the training, remote pilot in command is always the pilot. I guess... Maybe they use this terminology because you don't necessarily have to be the one operating the drone. Me as the Part 107 remote pilot in command, I could hand my controller to you, Nick, and you could fly the drone as long as I'm in command.
And if I disregard your instructions and violate FAA rules, it's on you.
It is, and I think I'm required to take back control.
I like the way this is going. We should build out our own little scene.
You can answer like three or four of the questions on the test by just understanding what the remote pilot in command is, because there are a series of questions that are along these lines that are like, who's responsible for checking to make sure the drone is working properly? Is it the guy on the street? Is it the manufacturer or is it the remote pilot in command? It's like all the questions are just trying to tell you, like, you are always in control. You are always responsible.
You are responsible for what happens. Got it.
Let's see if there's another one you could answer. Okay. I mean, this one seems obvious to me. If the remote pilot in command cannot determine the location of the SUAS, SUAS is Small Unmanned Aerial System, or aircraft system. If the remote pilot in command cannot determine the location of the drone in relation to other aircraft during night operations, when should he or she land the drone? A, within 10 minutes, B, immediately, C, at the end of the planned operation.
I'm going to guess B, immediately.
Yeah. Sounds like common sense. That's right.
I'm good. One for two. Now, by the way, are we going to get in trouble for sharing the questions live on the air?
I don't think so. I think here's how this test works. I don't know. There may be a larger pool than 45 questions, although these questions seemed like they tracked pretty closely to the training, so I have a feeling these are the 45 you get. I don't think the FAA wants to trip you up here. They want you to understand these things. So the way this test works is it's not pass or fail, and I don't even know how many tries you get. You might get infinite tries. Or maybe you just have to do it in 90 minutes. When I completed it, it's not satisfied with 93%. It wants me to get 100%, so it makes me re-answer the three questions until I get them right.
Oh, well, that's kind of smart, actually. It's like
you want
confirming
people to leave.
You understand all the rules. Yeah.
So here's a question that this is something I learned through the test, because one of the new regulations is now night flying is allowed without a special waiver. It used to be Part 107 pilots could only fly during civil twilight, which is 30 minutes after sunset or 30 minutes before sunrise. Okay. That was like the latest you could go. And I think you had to have anti-collision lights on your drone. Now the FAA is saying...
Which most do, right? Most, like, I think my little Spark has red and green navigation lights on it.
They have lights, but I don't think they're considered anti-collision lights.
Oh, okay.
In fact, that's another question on the test is, how many miles do you think those lights have to be visible to be anti-collision?
2 miles.
Pretty close. 3 miles is the right answer. So now, under the new flying at night regulations, you can fly at night. You just have to have the anti-collision lights on.
Do you know, do most of the larger drones have that now? Or lights that would qualify?
I don't think it's standard. I'm pretty sure, like with my, I have a DJI Mavic 2 Zoom here. I'm pretty sure I'd have to buy a third party light that clips onto the arms.
Interesting.
If I want to fly at night. But like one of the things they taught me in the training.
Let me ask you this. Are you flying under Part 107 when you fly in a hobbyist fashion?
You mean me as a certificate holder? Could I fly as a hobbyist?
Like, if you're just flying in your backyard to show your kid, are you held to all these rules, or are you a hobbyist at that point?
You know, that's a great question. I think you're right that I can be a hobbyist, because a lot of the questions in the test are kind of along those lines of, like, are you flying under 107 when you do X? So I suppose just because I have the certificate doesn't mean I have to always...
So you could do a little night flying in your backyard as long as you're not making a video, basically.
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I guess I didn't even consider if hobbyists are allowed to fly at night. I actually don't even know.
Oh, yeah, I just assumed we were, but what do I know?
Yeah. There are a variety of things that hobbyists can do that 107 can't, and vice versa. Like, I mean, I think hobbyists have a blanket rule about airports. I feel like it's something really wide, like 5 miles away from airports. You're just... You know, within a 5 mile radius, you're just not allowed to fly. Which
my home is within.
Yeah.
And I may have flown my drone in my backyard and down my street.
But that was one of the reasons I wanted to get the certification, was besides the commercial requirement that if you're going to make money, you need it. It was that if you, that you can request permission to fly within much, much closer. I still can't fly like over an airport, but I can pretty much fly half a mile away from an airport if I request the permission.
Just basically like under the Class B shelf probably, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so one of the things I learned about night flying, it has all this, because now night flying is allowed, it has all these new training, whole training module about night flying. They actually tell you when you're looking up at your drone, you should try to teach yourself to look 5 to 10 degrees away from it. Do you have any idea why?
Night vision?
Yeah. Do you understand like how the eye works, that would help?
When you look at something bright, your pupils dilate, and maybe if you don't look right at it, they don't dilate as much?
I think it's a matter of cones and rods that... I can't even remember which one's which, but whichever one is in the middle of your retina, that's the one that doesn't work at night very well. It's like you get all the detail in the center of your eye, but it's not great at low light. So if you're staring right at something in the night, you might not actually see it as well. But if you look like a little bit off center, the other part of your eye, is that the cones? Or I don't remember which one.
I don't know.
But that one can see it better.
Fun fact.
Maybe with less detail, yeah.
It seems like it would be hard to do, but...
Right, but I guess it's something you could try real quick if you're in the middle of a flight and you're looking up at your drone and you just realize, like, you're barely seeing it. You could try looking off center a little bit.
That is interesting.
And there's a whole page. I love all the stock photos in this training. Like, there's a picture of a guy, like, holding his neck, like, "Oh, my neck hurts." Has nothing to do with flying. But then the page is about the challenges of night flight and how it can have circadian rhythm effects on you and make you stressed out.
Oh my goodness.
Give you low blood sugar and
they really get detailed.
Yeah.
What are the rules around automated flying?
I think it's the same as, like, you know, as long as you, the remote pilot in command, are always, you know, you always have a contingency plan. You know your equipment is in good working order. You've practiced with the software.
You could program a GPS route for your drone, and as long as you've got your line of sight and everything, you're good to go.
Yeah, I suppose you still have to maintain line of sight, yeah.
That's cool. Does your drone do that? Can you, like, pre-program a route for it?
You can. There's some limited functionality like that built into the DJI app, but I've used, I'll pull up the apps that I've used. I have an app called Drone Deploy, and Drone Deploy is pretty cool. You can do, I've done like 3D photography with it where...
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, you haven't done that in a long time though, have you?
Yeah, you can just set it up to like, you map an area, you just like draw with your finger on a map on your phone and say like, I want to cover this whole area and I want a 3D map of this area. And then it routes its own flight path, which is pretty much just going like down, turn around, come back, turn around, come back, and just it crisscrosses the whole zone that you've mapped. And then it also flies it from a few different angles so that it can get all that 3D information. And then it stitches all this imagery together. And in the end, you have like this weird, looks like CGI version of your house and trees and stuff.
You should do that to your new house.
Yeah, I should. The first time I did it, though, it really freaked me out because it's like to let go of control and just to see it like fly quickly in one direction and you're not controlling it was pretty weird.
I love it.
Let's see, what was the other thing they added? Oh, the other thing they added, there were several pages of training on remote ID, which is this new requirement that the FAA is adding. My understanding is that drones will broadcast their location to the FAA, and so now the FAA can like track in real time what you're doing with your drone.
Sort of. They've made a couple changes, so I did do a little bit of digging on this.
Yeah, and this is where I need your help, because like I was answering some questions about it on the test without really understanding like what this means in the future. I don't even know when it goes into effect.
So it went into effect 8 days ago, April 21st, 2021.
Okay.
But the rules are that it's new drones that get released after that date have to include this remote ID feature. So if they've already been announced and they're just still selling it, I don't think that matters. But then any drone built after October 2022 has to have it built in. So if you design a new model today, you have to include it. If you build it after October of next year, it has to be built in. And then there's 30 months from that date before everything has to have it to even fly. So you have to retrofit old stuff to include it.
So what's the date that I need to retrofit my drone?
30 months from today, or from a week ago, which would be what? Sometime in 2023, like.
Yeah, okay.
So it's coming up, but not immediately.
In now, 2023, nice, though, is, when I go up and fly, the FAA will know what I'm doing. Is that the idea?
Sort of. So the initial proposal had what they called... network remote ID, where it actually had to have like built-in cellular or some ability to get online to share all that data, location and serial number and things like that. They removed that from the final rule. So it is a local broadcast only. So if the FAA were nearby, they could get that data, but it's not being transmitted to the FAA all the time. So it basically, it's a nice compromise, you know, local law enforcement or FAA, if there's a troublesome drone, can get that information off of it. But, you know, you can imagine having to have cellular connectivity being quite a onerous rule.
Yeah.
So they've removed
that. If you're flying on top of a mountain, you're not going to have cellular connection probably.
So what gets broadcast is either a serial number or what they call a session ID, which I don't fully understand, but my guess is if you don't want to share that serial number, you can probably go get, you know, registered for a session ID with the FAA that maybe, you know, you could change next time you go do something. But yeah, you have to broadcast either the serial number or session ID, and it will also broadcast latitude, longitude, altitude, and velocity.
And do we know, is this only for law enforcement and FAA, or is this like public broadcast that anyone could tap into?
I do not believe there's any kind of encryption or anything. So yes, I think anyone who's nearby can pull this information. Think of it like a license plate. The whole anyone in the public can see it, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything to them, right?
Well, yeah, that's how I kind of understood it. Because like currently, the requirement is that you have your FAA serial number. I can't remember what they're called. Your drone has a registration number. It has to be on the side of the drone, just like a plane has to have its tail number. And so I kind of understood remote ID kind of just sounds like a digital version of this. You need to be publicly broadcasting what you are.
Right. And that serial number or session ID will only be made available to authorized law enforcement and national security personnel upon request. So your personal information is protected, but your location and flying information is not, basically. They don't know your name, but they know exactly where your drone is and how fast it's going, et cetera.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So that's what needs to be built into the drone. And what it sounds like is most DJI drones made in the last few years already do this.
It's, do you think my Mavic 2 Zoom that was made, I don't know, 2 years ago or something?
Somebody had a list of what they, you know, the rules just got finalized, so I think there were some concerns, but let's take a look. You have a which kind do you have?
I have a Mavic 2 Zoom.
Yep, that's on the list for drones that already comply with broadcast remote ID.
Interesting, yeah. There's like, yeah, I feel like I saw some headline from DJI that was like, our drones are
even mine
ready to go.
The DJI Spark is on the list. So, and you know, that thing is 3 or 4 years old.
That thing's really old.
It's
tiny.
Yeah. A couple other things. If it's under that 250 gram limit and you're not flying Part 107, you don't have to do this.
Right. That was one of the questions on the test that I got right.
Yeah.
Because pretty much anything between, I think the way the FAA writes it is 0.55 pounds.
Okay.
Up to 55 pounds, I believe, is considered Part 107. But yeah, if you have like, I think that really lightweight Mavic, or not Mavic, or is it?
Whatever that new DJI one is.
Yeah, DJI has that really lightweight one. That's actually like too light to be considered Part 107.
Well, no, they said something, what I read was a little different. Basically, if I fly that drone as a hobbyist, I don't have to have remote ID on. If you fly it commercially, even though it's under the weight limit, you still have to have it turned on.
That was probably one of my questions that I probably got right and then already forgot. Like, that's the funny thing about this training. I mean, this was actually helpful to go through the training again, because there were all these rules that I generally understood, remembered the spirit of the rule but not the specifics. Like one of them was you're not allowed to drink alcohol 8 hours before a flight.
Really?
Yeah. I assume real pilots have a rule like that,
probably,
like even a sip, but I couldn't
don't know
remember
if
the
I'm
number
ever 8 hours away from a sip of alcohol.
Yeah.
Just
I think I misremembered it and thought it was 12 hours. So now I know I can drink within 8 hours of my flight, as long as I go to sleep.
But if it's 4th of July and I'm barbecuing and I've got a beer in hand, guess I can't fly my drone.
Yeah.
Maybe. Well, again, probably that's only Part 107, which I don't mess with. So, okay, a couple other things I just want to throw out there. If your drone does not have this Real ID built in, which, again, if it's announced after today or built after October of next year, it's going to have it built in. But if it doesn't, they're going to have these remote ID broadcast modules, which is basically like a little thing you can attach to your drone that will broadcast all the information you need to do. So that's going to be an option, or maybe for people who build their own drones or do that kind of thing, right?
Right.
And the third option is there are FAA recognized identification areas, which basically are predefined areas where you can fly things and don't need this turned on. So
yeah,
I would imagine a lot of like remote control airplane fields and things like that will apply for that, and hopefully you don't need to have it when you're flying in that area.
That's what I figured that
these
was.
Rules all apply, these rules apply to remote control airplanes and things that people have been doing forever too. So
yeah.
I don't think those groups are probably super excited about this new requirement. But hopefully this FAA recognized identification area allows them to get around that for, you know, their fields and things like that.
Yeah, I answered a couple questions about FRIAs and like understood the rule based on the training, but didn't really understand like what are those zones. But that's what I figured it must be, those airfields, those RC airfields.
Yep, we'll see.
Yeah.
But all in all, I mean, I think it strikes a pretty good balance, these rules, don't you think, in terms of, you know, you can imagine a lot of dangerous stuff people can do with drones, but you also don't want to limit people's ability to use them because they have so many cool hobby and potential commercial uses. So this feels like a good balance, like getting rid of that networking requirement so that it's just a local broadcast. And it seems to make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and generally, these new rules, I mean, we've been talking about several new rules. I mean, one of the new rules was just the fact that you can now take this test online. It feels like a lot of the rules are relaxing, except for the remote ID, which adds more requirements for your drone. But generally, they're now letting you do some night flying. They're now letting you take the test online. They're now letting you do some limited flights over people. It used to be kind of like, no people. If you want to fly over people, you need a waiver. And now there are a few categories where you're allowed to fly over people. I think one of them being like when your drone is really light and won't do any harm, you can fly over people.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And so I guess the main message I want to get across today is for anyone who does need to re-up their training, you should know that you can now do this online. You can just go to faasafety.gov. They have a bunch of tests there, online courses and things, but here's where you can find the free one. And to not get confused, you should look up the test. The test is called ALC-677. And it's confusing because the test name is called Part 107 Small UAS Recurrent. And so you have to know what all those things mean. Part 107 is the certification. Small UAS means drones. Recurrent means not initial, but the two-year one. But then this one's actually called Part 107 Small UAS Recurrent Non-Part 61 Pilots, because there is another test for Part 61 pilots that's been around prior to this test existing. It used to be that I think Part 61 is like real pilots. And they could get their drone recurrent online previously, but now the rest of us can.
Gotta love a good bureaucracy.
Yeah, this whole thing feels very like government website. Like it's just way too much language. And but in the end, I was glad that the test was not too hard. You can do this whole training and test in probably like 2 hours or less. And like I said, I don't think there's even any risk of you failing. I think they really want you to leave knowing everything.
That's cool.
One thing I think I might have been getting wrong this whole time that I learned during the training was it says it names the documents you need to carry around with you, like physical documents. And I don't think I've been walking around with my physical pilot certificate. I think I've been keeping it as like a PDF in my drone apps, but this makes it sound like I do need it in my physical possession. Although I don't know what that means legally.
Print a copy and throw it in your drone case and then you always have it.
Yeah. So it actually, I did feel like this was a useful, it wasn't wasting my time because it was pretty quick. And I did pick up a few details that were like, oh yeah, I probably should remember that stuff. I forgot that. It was much easier than the original test. That test takes like 2 weeks of training, I think.
Good. I'm glad.
And this test it kind of skipped a lot of categories that the original test had. The original test was a lot of like reading air maps, which the training touched on it. And then I don't think there was a single question about air maps. And then there's a lot of like weather questions on the initial test. And this time there was like one or two questions about hot air and how it moves upward, but there wasn't really any questions about like rain or clouds or anything like that. So pretty simple to get through.
Sounds like.
I think even you could pass this test.
Wow. It's kind of a backhanded compliment, I think.
Well, like I said, it's just
all
like
right,
it's set up to be like
how it's going
to
be.
A good test taker could pass this test without really knowing the subject matter, I think. There's one more slide I have here that I think is funny. I remember this from the initial test, and I just think it's funny that this is included. There's a whole section in the training about hazardous attitudes, and they bring this up in the context of if you're working with a crew, like you are the remote pilot in command, maybe you have a visual observer that's helping you track the location. Maybe you have another operator who's actually doing the controls. I guess they want to make sure that as the remote pilot in command, you can handle a team, you can be a leader. And so there are five hazardous attitudes they want you to be on the lookout for.
Okay.
One of them is anti-authority, and their example is don't tell me what to do. There's impulsivity, do it quickly. There's invulnerability, it won't happen to me. There's machoism, I can do it, I'll show them. This is like every character.
These all sound like you, Griffin.
These are all like characters in like a sci-fi film. The bad member of the team. And then the last.
When they come together, they form the Avengers.
The last hazardous attitude is resignation. What's the use? So if you encounter any
of these hazardous
attitudes.
It's going to kill everyone anyway. Why even try and be safe?
What's the use of putting on the anti-collision lights? We don't need them. I'm the best pilot we got.
Are you trying to combine more than one into a character now?
Oh, like, yeah, because I assume you're probably going to have multiple hazardous attitudes. So pretty much if you encounter a hotshot pilot, kick him off your squad.
What would Maverick from Top Gun be? Which of these? Well, should we thank our sponsor, Griffin?
We definitely should.
Haney Filmmakers is brought to you by Squarespace. From websites and online stores to marketing tools and analytics, Squarespace is the all-in-one platform to build a beautiful online presence and run your filmmaking business.
Speaking of business, I just am now current again with my Part 107 certification. I can now make money again with my drones. And so if you're like me and have the authority granted by the FAA to make some money with your drones or with any of your filmmaking equipment, now is a great time to get your business up and running. And with a Squarespace website, you can pitch yourself to your local community. Maybe aerial photography, you can do some aerial inspections, you can do weddings, all these things. But you're going to need a website to tell people what you're capable of and tell your story.
So check out squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/griffin to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. So I launched my new video.
I don't know if you noticed that. Your how to...
Synology Zero Tier Replication video.
We struggled with, like, how might you title this thing? Like, it sounds boring, but this is a video about... How do you take this storage device, this remote storage device, drop it at another location and just have it work? Just start backing up all your files without having to mess with firewalls and stuff, which is actually, I think, a great use case.
Exactly. So I took my second Synology over to my parents' house because they got gigabit Ethernet, or gigabit internet, I should say. Which I'm super jealous of. But I didn't have to log into their router and set a static IP address and do port forwarding and all that kind of nonsense. So this video is about how to configure it beforehand in such a way that you just plug it in and turn it on and it works. And so I was pretty happy with how it turned out. It does not seem to be taking the world by storm, but I'm not surprised. It's a fairly niche topic, but hopefully it's helpful to some people.
Yeah, it's helpful to me because I'm also a Synology NAS user. And interestingly enough, my mom just moved to a place where now she has a half gigabit internet. She has 500 megabits up and down. So I could probably do the same thing.
Yeah. Although I have plenty of space on my primary one. I could always carve you out a little little replication target and just add you to this zero tier network I'm on, and it would work just the same. So yeah, we can talk about that another time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've got a video. 132 views, please. Griffin. 132. So watch out.
Yeah, how did your hard drive shucking video get so many views?
There's just a lot more people doing that, I think. Let's take a look at it, shall we? That's still my top video. That in the past, what am I looking at here? Last 28 days, my hard drive shucking video has 1,459 views.
And what is it total, like 100,000?
It is currently at, let's see, since upload. I've been digging into the YouTube analytics. It's pretty cool. They give you a lot of data. It's at 161,000 views.
There's a piece of data in there that I did not even know about. I remember asking back when I worked for YouTube in, like, when was that? From 2011 to 2013. I remember wanting this metric and asking about it. And even I think in the years after I worked at YouTube, asking about this metric. And they have it now, and I somehow never noticed it. It's probably been there for years now. They give you like a heat map of when your subscribers are online to kind of give you a sense of when might you want to upload. And it turns out,
where do you find that?
It was pretty easy. It was like analytics subscribers. I think they use the term audience. And I think
audience,
it's right on that page.
I'm looking for it. When your viewers are on YouTube.
Yeah.
Look at that. Do you know what it says for mine?
No.
To say not enough, viewer data to show this report.
Yeah.
I mean, it probably works for you.
It probably would take thousands of subscribers to really give you like a real sense. In fact, if your subscribers are few enough, I wonder if YouTube is not showing it to you because it's a privacy issue. Like,
oh, probably, right?
If you have one subscriber and it's your significant other, you know, it would like tell you exactly when they're online, which is creepy.
My watch time from subscribers, 97.6% not subscribed. So whoever's out there watching the hard drive shucking video, can you throw me a subscribe, man? That's all I'm asking.
Well, maybe
I don't ask for subscribes in my video. Maybe that's why I need to say
maybe
like
they're
and subscribe.
Watching and then they bell. Subscribe. So the
maybe
you're maybe. Racking up all that. Mine's like that too, though. I think 75% of my viewership is non-subscribers, because I think that's YouTube. That's the YouTube ecosystem is like discovering videos.
Now, my new video, it's fun. I'm just clicking through all these analytics. 57% of my audience is still watching after 30 seconds. That seems pretty good.
That's great, yeah.
So, you know, half the people are like, what the hell did I just start clicking on? But the other half are like, oh, yeah, no, that's what I want to know.
And I've always seen pretty high numbers of people drop off. Again, I think it's because YouTube kind of encourages people to discover content. So you're always going to have a significant number of people drop off in the first 10 seconds because they click on something and then realize, oh, this is not what I want at all. I was looking for something else. I mean, I think I've always seen it like at least a 25% drop on anything.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I think if you can make it like to the end of a video with still 50%, that's a success. That a significant number of people stuck around for the whole thing.
So I think that ends my analytics roadshow.
I think the thing I learned from the heat map is, oh, look, my audience is online from 10 a.m. until the early afternoon, like 2 p.m. every day. And I think the thing that surprised me is it's like more in the middle of the week, like Wednesday. Well, actually, that shouldn't surprise me because the podcast goes out every Wednesday. So, but I don't know. That doesn't mean my subscribers all flock to YouTube to watch my content.
Yeah,
and
but they get notified
else.
Of it then, probably. So yeah. I bet you the biggest chunk come right away.
So I guess the podcast is landing at a good time. Wednesday is when subscribers are online anyway. But I always would have suspected that, like, somehow I assumed Fridays and Saturdays would be good days, like days that people aren't working. But if anything, it may be the opposite. It may be that when people
say,
are at
work. People watch YouTube while they're working.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because, yeah, actually, it looks like Saturday and Sunday, people are probably outside doing other things. They're not on YouTube
right.
in as big numbers. at least my audience.
All right, my friend.
Oh, I want to
call that an episode.
I want to say one more thing before we go. I just want to thank everyone who participated in the YouTube garage sale in the last episode. It was a success. It went really quickly and easily. I got a bunch of responses. Even before there were any comments on the video, there were people streaming into the spreadsheet. People were requesting to buy some of the stuff I'm selling.
Racing to the spreadsheet.
Yeah. So I think in the first 24 hours, I had everything sold.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So thank you for helping me get rid of some stuff I didn't need, give it a nice new home, and recover some cash that I can put towards stuff I actually do need.
Like maybe a new drone pilot. I'm gonna start calling you Pilot.
Thanks. Yeah. Pilot Hammond.
All right, Pilot Hammond. I will talk to you later.
I'll talk to you later, hobbyist Nick.
Bye. We're gonna cut and we're gonna wait for people to be quiet.